Hi, I'm Doug Phillips, the podcast editor for the American Journal of Neuroradiology. It's my pleasure to bring for you this month the October podcast from the American Journal of Neuroradiology with our editors and fellows choices. Let's begin with the editor's choices for this month. The first paper by Kim et al., The Influence of Carotid Artery Catheterization Technique on the Incidence of Thromboembolism During Carotid Artery Stenting. This paper was first published online July 1, 2010. The risk of procedure-related stroke is one of the main concerns when performing carotid artery stenting and has actually prevented this technique from becoming more widely accepted. In this paper, the authors evaluated using diffusion-weighted imaging 32 patients who underwent carotid artery stenting involving two very different catheterization techniques. The first group, catheterization performed solely with a 7 or 8 French catheter, and the other group were catheterized using a coaxial system. The larger of the coaxial catheter system of either 7 or 8 French in conjunction with diagnostic catheters in the 4 to 5 French range. Post-carotid artery stenting infarctions were found in 53% of patients and were significantly more common in those over the age of 65. All of the infarctions found post-procedurally were asymptomatic, and their incidence in the territory of the treated artery was similar for both techniques. On the other hand, infarctions outside of the territory of the treated artery were significantly higher in the first group. The author's conclusion: infarctions in the other territories mainly arise from the atherosclerotic aortic arch and arch vessels during the manipulation of endoluminal catheters for the diagnostic phase of this angiography. The carotid artery catheterization technique using the coaxial system with a 7 or 8 French guiding catheter in conjunction with a 4 or 5 French catheter reduced the incidence of strokes in the other vascular territories. In the rapidly advancing world of interventional neuroradiology, release and adoption of new technologies is essentially the same. Testing and development of many of these new systems is under the direction of vendors and can be a problematic item. It is important to realize that subsequent utilization in the real-world setting is often somewhat different than what might happen or has been planned to happen during the economic phase of some technology development. In this regard, papers such as this, looking at the real-world experience of interventional neuroradiologists with these systems, becomes very important. Our second paper, Editor's Choice, by Jackson et al., Cost-Effectiveness of CT Perfusion for Selecting Patients for Intravenous Thrombolysis, a U.S. Hospital Perspective. This paper was first published online June 20, 2010. If patients were selected for IV tPA based on the presence of a penumbra, as seen on a perfusion study, perhaps their outcome could be improved. The authors here assumed a, quote, limited availability of MRI in the hospital, end quote, and thus have decided to use CT alone for their study. They studied the costs and outcomes associated with the selection of patients for IV tPA thrombolysis based on the presence of a penumbra on a CT perfusion study. Thrombolysis was based not on clinical grounds or on multimodality imaging such as CTA, CTP, or in combination with other examinations such as MR, MRI, DWI studies. The authors have concluded that using a penumbra-based CT perfusion study after routine CT to select patients with ischemic stroke for intravenous thrombolysis with IV tPA is cost-effective compared with the usual CT-based methods. With the ease of access of CT perfusion, penumbra-based selection methods may be readily available to many hospitals, if not already in place and merely waiting to be more widely instituted and adopted. Thus, this economic analysis may lend further support to the consideration of a paradigm shift in acute stroke evaluation. Many have said that the next growth industry of scientific publications is in cost-benefit or cost-effectiveness analysis. We in medicine, and particularly those of us in the imaging field, have embraced new technologies as they are introduced, and we have tended to view anyone with anything other than our own opinion as some kind of technological nihilist. We are finding that insurers and many healthcare analysts do not care much for our views in this regard. In truth, I feel that we have very little to fear in these kind of cost-effectiveness and cost-benefit studies. Medical decision-making has become very dependent on the introduction of information gained by many of our tests. For sure, there will be tests that are winners and tests that are losers, and we will have to be flexible in our choices and in our directing patient management and the choice of their imaging studies. If we do not perform these studies ourselves, it's very easy to see that someone else will be doing these studies for us. The next paper, The Editor's Choices, by Delgado Amondiz et al., entitled Practical Scoring System for the Identification of Patients with Intracerebral Hemorrhage at Highest Risk of Harboring an Underlying Vascular Etiology, the Secondary Intracerebral Hemorrhage Score. This paper was first published online June 25, 2010. From the same institution as the previous study on CT perfusion cost-effectiveness comes this paper that aims to develop a practical scoring scheme to stratify patients with brain hemorrhage according to their risk of harboring an underlying vascular etiology, such as intracranial aneurysm, arteriovenous malformation, etc. They retrospectively reviewed 623 patients who underwent CTA, and based on this review, developed a scoring system based on their findings, and then applied it subsequently to 222 new patients that came through the emergency department. Patients with typical basal cistern subarachnoid hemorrhage, indicative of intracranial aneurysm rupture, were excluded. Vascular lesions were found in 120 of 845 patients, the most common being an aneurysm that had ruptured into a purely intracerebral location. Their scoring system successfully predicted a given intracranial hemorrhage patient's risk of harboring an underlying vascular etiology and could be used as a guide to select patients with ICH for additional neurovascular evaluation to exclude the presence of a vascular abnormality.
Hi, it's Doug Phillips speaking this afternoon with Dr. Javier Romero. Dr. Romero is the director of the Neurovascular Laboratory at the Massachusetts General Hospital. He's an instructor at Harvard Medical School and a staff neuroradiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Romero, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
So your paper on the CTA evaluation of intracranial hemorrhage and your proposal for a scoring system, one of our editor's choices this month, I would very much appreciate it, and our listeners would too, if you could distill the paper down for us, give us kind of the basics of it, and a few points that you feel are important.
Absolutely. Our paper called Practical Scoring System for the Identification of Patients with Intracerebral Hemorrhage at Highest Risk of Harboring an Underlying Vascular Etiology. And more to say, it's a secondary intracerebral hemorrhage score. It was based on our feel that we needed a way to approach our patients that had non-traumatic ICH. And to give a little bit of background, non-traumatic ICH accounts for 10 to 15% of all acute strokes. But not only that, it really is one of the most deadly types of stroke, accounting for 50% of our patients with IPH die of this catastrophic stroke. Not only that is that, as radiologists, one of our major roles is to detect vascular abnormalities. We know that the timely and accurate identification of patients with secondary intracranial hemorrhage is extremely important because you can apply some therapy and decrease the rate of rehemorrhage on patients with primary ICH. We also have seen in the literature that if a patient, such as a patient with an AVM during the first year, may have a risk of rehemorrhage of 18%, and even patients with aneurysms in the first 14 days have a risk of reaching of 25% of rehemorrhage. So it is extremely critical for radiologists to know which patients are going to harbor a intracranial hemorrhage. For this purpose, we try to approach our patients in the emergency department. The way we performed this study was based on a previous database of 623 patients with intracranial hemorrhage that were studied in the emergency department with multi-detector CTA. This trial was during a period of 9 years, and we developed the score based on the clinical characteristics that these patients had at the time they presented to the ED. Which were the most relevant points? The most relevant points were the patient's age, the patient's gender, the knowledge of the patient having hypertension or being anticoagulated, or just looking at the non-contrast CT and determining if this was a high risk for predicting vascular lesion or a low risk. A little bit going to detail, how did we detail which patient had a high probability in non-contrast CT? And we found that if a patient had a non-CT with enlarged vessels or calcifications along the margins of the intracranial hemorrhage, or had a hyperattenuation within the dural venous sinuses and cortical veins along the presumed venous drainage of that area of the intracranial hemorrhage, this was presumed to be a high probability non-contrast CT to have a vascular lesion. We also looked at the patient's age, and we found that patients between the ages of 18 and 45 years old were the ones at higher risk of having underlying vascular abnormality. Also, we found that females also had a high proportion of harboring a vascular abnormality, and particularly those patients without hypertension or without anticoagulation also had a higher risk for having vascular abnormality. So having that in mind, we build a score, and the score goes up to 6 points, and we found very interesting results. And it turns out if a patient can accumulate about 3 points within this score, his risk of having a vascular abnormality reaches 20%. If this patient goes to a score of 4, his risk of having an abnormality goes up, doubles to 40%. If he has a score of 5, his risk goes to 84%, another doubling number. And once he reaches the maximum point of 6, his risk is almost 100%. So having this in mind, that a patient with his clinical information and the characteristics of a non-contrast CT, we do this score, we believe that is pretty powerful in trying to predict if this patient has an underlying lesion. Which would be the value of this? We think that having this would be a very nice way of triaging our patients and which patients should require advanced imaging in our emergency departments in an urgent fashion, and also look at which treatments are these patients probably are going to need in his future hospitalization. This spot sign score really predicts the risk of harboring an underlying vascular etiology. And we believe that when we applied it to our 222 prospective patients, we found very similar numbers in terms of positive CTAs. Again, we found 20%, 40%, 80%, and 100% in this order for patients categorized in the 3, 4, 5, and 6 spot sign score. So all this data points out that probably we can, in future, triage our patients in a systematic way and really have serious cost-effective studies on which imaging may be the best to look at our patients with vascular abnormalities.
So the paper in that stratified risk evaluation really points up the idea that some patients really urgently and emergently need to get that vascular evaluation, and for some of the others, it may not be indicated, which is very interesting because your paper was stratified with patients who were, I presume from reading it, that they were essentially there for a multi-detector CTA examination at the time. Do you think that at some point we may be able to, based on the scoring, say that there are a group of those patients who really don't need to go on to CTA, their scores are low enough, clinical information is strong enough that they don't need the CTA examination to follow?
That is a very good question, and we do believe that the only way of answering is looking at cost effectiveness. And certainly if your only goal is to detect an underlying vascular abnormality, I agree with you that if you have a very low score, probably this is not the most cost-effective exam. However, we've seen in the literature also proposed by my group and other groups in Canada and Cincinnati where they apply CTA and looking at spot sign with a more predictive value of looking at which patients are going to expand and which are not. This is also in the works and trying to triage patients which may require urgent treatment such as evacuation or application of medications just like factor 7 or other upcoming coagulation medication.
Right. So, I mean, this, as it's laid out here for us, I mean, this is an incredibly important paper for all of us in interpreting intracranial hemorrhage examinations from the emergency department. But I think it also points up very importantly the idea that clinical information factors in there, and it's a critical part of how we approach the interpretation of the exams and what we might recommend from that point.
Correct. This was, in fact, one of the major questions of a prior study that was done by the Scotland group of Cordonnier. His group has a systematic review and trinational survey regarding precisely this question. How should we focus our patients that come to our emergency department with an intraparenchymal hemorrhage? They did a survey among three nations with hundreds of neurologists, stroke neurologists, and also neuroradiologists, where basically they found that there was not a consensus in how to approach our patients. Not only some groups were more aggressive with the younger patients than others, some groups were more aggressive with those patients with hypertension. So there was not a very standardized way of approaching our patients. We believe that this score system may help us in the emergency department in triaging our patients in better fashion.
Do you feel that MR or MRA studies have contribution in this regard, or do you think that CT answers these questions adequately?
I think that for patients with vascular abnormalities in particular, I think CTA answers the question 100%. However, not all of our patients with intracranial hemorrhage or spontaneous hemorrhage are secondary to vascular abnormalities. This paper was more focused in the realm of trying to focus which patients should go to neurosurgery treatment or interventional treatment than those patients that have, let's say, a primary IPH or an intracranial hemorrhage secondary to a tumor or amyloid angiopathy. We believe that MRI is fundamental in trying to diagnose those patients where you do have a suspicion of having an underlying neoplasia or having amyloid angiopathy or having other primary reasons of having an intraparenchymal hemorrhage. And I think it's pivotal. I think that probably the first line of, because of how fast and rapid acquisition, CT is being more and more used in our emergency departments than MR.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the cost-effectiveness angle that you've introduced is critical consideration for all of us. As we watch healthcare dollars contracting, we are being called more and more to explain why we do what we do and to have some means of justifying what we do.
Correct.
Insurers will pay for the things, but they certainly want to know that it's a reasonable expenditure of healthcare dollars.
Correct. I think that was one of the really needs that this systematic review did, was that we need to know exactly and prove, as you mentioned, what it was the worth of our imaging for each one of our patients. And I think the score system will tell you that if at certain degrees of score, it is very valuable.
Absolutely. You all have obviously put out an excellent work here. Where do you think we go from here in the evaluation of these patients? What additional work needs to be done? Do you think this paper is a good starting point? Do you think it's somewhere along the way? Where do you see us going from here?
One of the most challenging portions of imaging patients with intraparenchymal hemorrhage is really the algorithm we have to use. And our algorithm is fundamentally based on CT angiography. But I highlight your question when you mentioned, where does MRI fit? Where does MRA fit? Where does conventional angiogram fit in all this algorithm of looking at our patients? And I think that our challenge for the future is really to build a concise, cost-effective, and tailored exam for patients with intraparenchymal hemorrhage. We can see how this is certain for our patients with ischemic infarction, where there's certain detailed protocols of how our patients going through our hospitals are treated, our image. However, for intraparenchymal hemorrhage, these criteria are not well defined. And I think looking into the future, the algorithm is critical, and also proving that we are doing a good job with our patients.
All very good points. I'd like to very much thank you for joining us this afternoon and talking about your paper with our listeners. I'm sure that everyone's taken a few points away from this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the invitation.
Now let's move on to the fellows' choices for this month. The first paper by Alamari et al. Entitled Klippel-Trenaunay Syndrome and Spinal Arteriovenous Malformations, an Erroneous Association. This article represents good use of existing literature to shed light into the manifestations of an uncommon disease or an uncommon association. The authors searched Medline and reviewed books to assess the relationship of KTS and spinal AVMs. In addition, they searched their personal databases for KTS cases and also looked for this association. They found 24 reports of spinal AVMs in 31 patients with KTS. It seems that the diagnosis of KTS was not well established in any of these patients. In their own database, they found 208 KTS patients and none had AVMs. Thus, the known, or perhaps we should say surmised, association between AVMs and KTS is most likely erroneous. This paper would seem to open a potential door on other low-incidence associations. The next paper for a fellow's choice by Takanashi et al., entitled Clinical and Radiologic Features of Rotavirus Cerebellitis. This article was chosen because the editors and many of the rest of us find that viral cerebellitis is included in the differential diagnosis of what are often nonspecific T2 changes in the cerebellum. In this paper, the authors retrospectively analyzed the MRI, clinical, and laboratory data in cases of rotavirus cerebellitis handled through several Japanese hospitals. 11 of 13 patients had supratentorial findings in addition to the cerebellitis, while clinically nearly all developed mutism early in the course of the disease, in addition to typical cerebellar abnormalities such as dysarthria, ataxia, dysmetria, etc. The most common sites of abnormalities were the vermis and cerebellar cortex, as well as a reversible splenial lesion. Some cerebellar lesions were also transient, and nearly all patients showed cerebellar atrophy in the chronic stages. The point here? Clinical info rules. Nonspecific imaging findings without the associated clinical stigmata of a potential diagnosis should instruct us in not including every item that we may know in our listing of differential considerations. The next paper by Lowe et al., entitled The Risk of Acute Radiocontrast-Mediated Kidney Injury Following Endovascular Therapy for Acute Ischemic Stroke is low. This paper was first published online June 3, 2010. When performing endovascular recanalization of acute stroke patients, the interventional neuroradiologist may use significant amounts of iodinated contrast material. Patients may undergo CTA on admission with a CT perfusion examination. They may then go emergently to the angiography suite for angiographic confirmation, as well as for lysis, with multiple angiographic runs performed to assess the progress of therapy. Here, the authors assess the risk of contrast-induced nephropathy after this type of treatment. 99 acute stroke patients were treated, and their kidney function was assessed before the procedure and 48 hours later. The average amount of contrast used in this group was about 190 mL of contrast. Three patients developed nephropathy, which resolved before all of them died from their stroke and complications. Higher morbidity rates were present in the usual suspect group, patients with diabetes, with chronic renal disease, with high creatinine levels on admission, etc. The author's conclusion, the risk of contrast-induced nephropathy of endovascular stroke recanalization is very low, but larger studies are needed to confirm this finding. Parenthetically, are we approaching a near full circle maneuver with regards to iodinated contrast media? It seems it was not more than 5 or so years ago we vilified iodinated contrast media and always recommended gadolinium-based contrast agents for patients with any suspicion of some difficulty in dealing with a bolus of iodinated contrast agents. Some of us have been around long enough to remember extensive vascular evaluations in patients with many GI tract abnormalities, occasionally seeing contrast dosage loads into the 500 cc range or higher, with very rare instances of contrast-induced nephropathy. We continue to learn more about the safety profiles of these compounds, and the safety profiles of the newer agents continue to improve. That's our podcast for the month of October. My name is Doug Phillips. I appreciate you listening. We'll talk to you again next month.